The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this is the second week of our class on the mindfulness of the body. And since we're having a householder retreat this week, which is a intensive week of practice in daily life, I thought I would speak on working with the body in daily life tonight. It actually is very convenient because I talked about the breath last week, and that's the first instruction that the Buddha gives about working with the breath, working with the body is working with the breath. The second and third instructions he gives are about working with the body in daily life. So when we think of mindfulness practice, I think a lot of us kind of equate it with the sitting practice. And that's where a lot of us begin with mindfulness practice, in silent meditation. But since the bulk of our day isn't spent in silence or in stillness, we're missing a huge opportunity if we don't also see if we can learn how to cultivate mindfulness in our daily life. And it's really a huge opportunity for us, because when we sit in silence, we're not rubbing up against the world too much. We are rubbing up against our minds, and it's the same mind we take out into the world. So there's a lot that we learn about our reactivity when we sit in silent meditation. But when we actually go out into the world and start rubbing up against things, we really hit that, the reactivity. So it's a wonderful place. It's a really great opportunity to learn how to cultivate an awareness of what's happening for us. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, the sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness, the instructions on the body, as I said, there are two sections on awareness in daily life. And I'll just briefly go through each of these, or I'll briefly read part of this section. So the first part is about focusing on the bodily postures. And it's pretty simple instructions. I'll read it. When walking, understand I am walking. When standing, understand I am standing. When sitting, understand I am sitting. And when lying, understand I am lying. So that's pretty basic. And I'll just stick to this basic aspect for now. It goes on in a little bit more detail, looking at knowing this internally, knowing it externally, knowing it internally and externally. And this definition of internal and external is not very clear, and there's various theories about what it means. Some people say it means knowing yourself that you're sitting and then knowing that other people are sitting. Some people say it has something to do with internal and external sense spaces. You know, do you know internally whether you're sitting physically or know from the outside whether you're sitting? I'm not sure what that one is about, but so we're not going to go into that part, and we're really going to just focus on the very basics of when sitting, know you're sitting, when standing, know you're standing, when walking, know you're walking, when lying, know you're lying. These are the four basic postures. Everything that we do is in one of these postures. So he suggests basically knowing that you're in the posture when you're in the posture. So it's a basic, very simple instruction, a lot of simplicity. And there's one teacher who died recently, who was Joseph Goldstein's teacher, who over and over again told Joseph, sit and know you're sitting, and the whole of the Dharma will unfold for you. So he had the faith in that single instruction even, that that's all you have to do, is just know that you're sitting and just keep coming back over and over again, and you will eventually see impermanence, you will see suffering, and you will understand not self. You will understand ephemerality just through this practice of coming back and sitting and knowing you're sitting. So in exploring this in our lives, often if we decide to start trying to pay attention to these things, start paying attention to sit and know you're sitting in your daily life, you'll start to notice that the purpose that you're doing, the reason you're sitting down or the reason you're doing the posture often simply obscures the posture, knowing the posture. So, for example, we get up to go to a meeting and we're walking to the meeting, and because we've got this purpose of going to the meeting, we're thinking about the meeting and we completely forget about the fact that we're walking. So we don't know that we're walking while we're walking. We're thinking about the meeting. We're projecting ahead to where we're going. And this happens to us a lot when we're walking. We are not so much aware of the fact that we're walking. We are thinking about where we're going to. Or, for example, we sit down to have a meal with a friend, and the conversation with the friend is much more interesting than the fact that we're sitting. So we completely forget about the fact that we're sitting. So even just keeping track in a very light way. Now, I'm not suggesting you ignore your friend and simply sit there knowing I'm sitting, knowing I'm sitting, knowing I'm sitting. That's not very realistic. In our daily lives, we need to find a way to pay attention where there's kind of an awareness of the context of what's happening and an awareness of what's happening. So in this case, you know, just kind of have the recognition. See if you can all, while you're sitting here listening to me tonight, just kind of keep track of the fact that you're sitting. Just keep track of that. But you're still listening to me. You're still taking that in. You still know what you're doing. So there's this larger context that you're aware of. But that doesn't have to obscure the mindfulness. We can still be mindful and in contact with the context of what's happening. One of my teachers in Burma, Sayadaw Tejaniya, talks about having a kind of a 50-50 split of our awareness when we are practicing in daily life. 50% of our attention on what we're doing, the content of what we're doing, so sitting and talking with a friend, for instance, and 50% of the attention on the awareness of what's happening. So that there's a balance between where the attention is. Often our attention is so far out there, we just lose track of our own experience. So seeing if we can just connect with the simple fact of sitting. Or walking, or standing. So there's some benefits to this simple practice of paying attention to the posture. Some attention to the posture might reveal some kind of underlying emotional state, tension, fear, excitement, agitation, boredom, because we get tense or contracted. We might find our shoulders coming up or hands clenched or jaw clenched. So some attention to the body can help reveal some underlying emotions and moods. We might also notice some patterns and habits around particular postures. So, for example, we might notice a lot that when we're walking, we're rushing. So when if we are in an office situation, we often find that we're rushing when we're moving around the office building. So simply observing the situation of the walking and the rushing, we might begin to recognize that we've got a habit of being late. And that just continuing to observe that, we might notice that that habit of being late has an underlying cause of of a perfectionist tendency to get everything done at the last minute so that the presentation will be perfect, so that we're kind of in our office finishing everything up right to the last second before we have to rush off to the meeting. Or perhaps it might reveal not particularly wanting to go to the meeting and lagging back. It's like an avoidance of conflict kind of thing. And so waiting until the last minute to put yourself in that room where this conflict is going to happen. There's so many different things that get revealed when we simply start paying attention to how our bodies function. There's a couple of practices around the postures that I like to suggest that people play with. One of them has to do with the practice of noticing when you change postures. So it may feel a little bit heavy or something, or to just keep recognizing, I'm sitting, I'm sitting, I'm sitting, I'm sitting, I'm sitting. But this practice of recognizing when you change postures, it's a pretty large action. And we probably do it, four or five times an hour, maybe. We go from standing to sitting to standing to walking to standing to sitting. And at the end of the day, we go from standing to sitting to lying. So there's some pretty major shifts. And often when we are just changing postures, there's a fairly strong intention behind it. There's a reason why we change postures. So in that practice of starting to pay attention when we change postures, we also have an opportunity to look at the intention or the reason why we change the posture. And this is an interesting practice for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that as we start to pay attention to our reasons, why we get up. I mean, we might find that we're sitting looking at the computer and, something's going on and we're just so frustrated we can't stand any longer to sit there, so we get up to go get a drink of water or a candy bar or whatever to just get away from that frustrating situation. So another possibility might be you're sitting at the computer and you realize you're thirsty. You need to get a drink of water. So you get up and go get a drink of water. So those are two very different scenarios. And they're two very different intentions behind the change of posture. So if you start paying attention to the change of posture, you will at some point be able to recognize and know before you change your posture. So you're sitting there at your computer, and if you've got this intention set to notice when you change postures, you might at some point start to recognize, I'm getting ready to stand up. So you'll know you're going to stand before you stand. And in that moment, you'll probably also know the reason. You'll also know why you're going to stand up. And at that moment, you can check in. What is that reason? The reason is likely to be, it could be motivated by greed, it could be motivated by aversion, or it could be motivated by simple bodily needs, it could be motivated by compassion, it could be motivated by generosity. So there's a lot of different motivations that we could have, but probably, I'd say, a good more than half of our intentions are motivated from greed and aversion. So we can start to recognize when we are being pushed and pulled around by these habitual tendencies of mind, of just so much frustration about how this computer's working that you just kind of get up and stomp off. Now, I'm not saying that you should not give yourself a break from the computer when you get frustrated. I'm not saying that because you notice that you are experiencing frustration that you should just sit there and experience the frustration. But at least recognize that that frustration is there and allowing yourself hopefully to let yourself chill out and then hopefully take a break for a skillful reason. Like, Okay, I find myself getting pretty tense here. I think I better just get up and let my body relax for a bit. So that it's not so much out of reactivity that you're springing away from the computer, and more out of a skillful purpose. A more skillful, supportive purpose for your health. So this is one of the ways that paying attention to this change of posture can be interesting. It helps us to recognize, because it's such a gross action, because it's such an obvious thing, we will be able to at some point catch the fact that we're getting ready to stand up, and we'll be able to see the motivations associated with it and see whether they're motivated out of skillful states of mind or unskillful states of mind. Unskillful states of mind being those motivated out of greed, aversion, or delusion. Those states of mind tend to lead us to suffering, to stress, to dissatisfaction. Skillful states of mind, such as generosity, compassion, kindness, joy, those states tend to lead us towards non-suffering. So if we can see what our motivations are, we have a little bit of a chance to intervene and potentially shift so that we're not being so reactive as we take the action. Does this make sense? There's another interesting piece about paying attention to this change of posture. And this has to do with a little bit deeper insight. It has to do with beginning to see that all we are is a collection of patterns unfolding in experience. That there's no one running the show, there's no one really doing anything, no one really experiencing anything. So as we begin to look at the intention, what we start to see is that intention itself has a cause. So all that happens is there's some cause that comes up that creates the motivation to change the posture. So that's cause. The motivation to change the posture is caused by something else. And then the motivation to change the posture causes the change of posture. So for example, that may sound kind of abstract. I'll make it concrete. So you're sitting at your computer. I'll go back to the computer. I spend a lot of time in front of my computer. You're sitting at the computer, and you've been sitting there for a while, a couple of hours. And because of that, thirst arises. So the sitting at your computer for a couple of hours without a glass of water nearby has been the cause for thirst. The thirst causes the motivation to get some water. The motivation to get some water prompts us to stand up. So it's simply this series of causes and effects. And it's not so much that we decide to, it feels like we decide to get up and get some water. But when you start actually exploring the experience in moment to moment as it unfolds, you experience these things as discrete events, and you see, oh, thirst, oh, wanting water, oh, wanting to stand. And it's just like boom, boom, boom. And you see it's not what you're not doing it. It's like it's just happening in your experience. And as we start to see that, we start to see that all of our experience is like that. And this is what I would call evidence for this quality of, or this characteristic, or perhaps perception of not self. So simply observing the change of posture can begin to open a little doorway to actually seeing just how causes and conditions unfold. And we can start to see, wow, this is just what's happening. I'll give another example of kind of seeing this not-self quality. I thought of this example this morning. I was observing, it wasn't so much postures, but I was observing bodily movement. I was on retreat. I'll have to move this for a second. And I had gotten myself a glass of water, and I was in the dining hall, and I was walking to my place where I was going to sit down. And I saw my hand change a glass of water to the other hand. I was like, wow, why did I do that? I just watched it happen. You know, it's like I saw it happen. And I was mindful, so I realized that it happened, and I had no idea why. And I stepped up to my chair, and I reached for the chair with my right hand and realized that was why I had switched hands. I'm right-handed. I tend to do things with my right hand. And it kind of was shocking to me. I mean, I hadn't even known what was going on. It was just like this separate entity kind of doing things, and I was just, you know, observing it. Now, this teaching on not self is challenging, usually, for people. So it's not something to believe. It's really not something to just take in and say, okay, I believe I'm not a self. Experience, once we have kind of taken this in as a teaching, sometimes it can make us curious about exploring our experience. And then we might start finding out that there's actually evidence for it in our experience, such as what I've just described, some of these things I've just described. But if we didn't have this kind of teaching in the back of our mind, it would be so far out of the realm of possibility, there'd be no way that we would even consider that this evidence, what this evidence meant. It would just be kind of missed as evidence for this not-self perception. So it's not something to believe. I'm not asking you to believe it, but I am asking you to explore your experience. Explore when you're changing postures, explore intention, and see what happens. And if I have time, I may talk a little bit more about this later on too. There's another practice I like to suggest. So the first one that I like to suggest people play with in their daily life with respect to postures is this changing postures. And to engage in this, this is something I've been talking about all week with my householder retreat, but to engage in this, partly what you have to do is to set your intention that you will try to remember this. Just try to remember, I'm going to be mindful when I change postures. And what will happen probably is that you won't remember until you go to bed at night or something like that. You know, you will have been changing postures all day long and you're going to bed and it's like, wow, I've forgotten all day long. That is not an indication that you have failed and that you should just give it up. It's actually the first moment when it has begun. It's kind of equivalent to remembering when you've wandered off in meditation. You're sitting in meditation and, you know, you're wandering off in thought and you remember, oh, I'm not paying attention to my body or I'm not paying attention to the breath. So In that case, we can come back to the breath. We can come back to the body. But this resolve to remember about changing postures will at some point trigger the remembering, oh, I've forgotten to do that. Just like it in the sitting meditation, oh, I've forgotten to pay attention to my breath. That moment when you remember is a moment of mindfulness itself. So now you've got a moment you can just pay attention of just whatever's happening. What posture are you in right now? You're in some posture. Recognize that, know that. And then resolve again to remember that you're going to be mindful when changing postures. Over time, this repeating resolve will bear fruit. And you will, at some point, be able to recognize when you're changing postures. And then after that's been going on for a little while, then you'll probably start to recognize before you're changing your postures. And then you can start to explore this intention. This whole process may take weeks before it really unfolds and flowers for you. But I found that the key is two qualities, resolve and patience. So keep resolving to engage in this practice and be patient when it takes a long time, because it will. It will take some time to work. A second practice on posture that I like to talk about is a walking practice, a daily life walking practice. And there's two parts to it, or there's two different kind of styles of it. The first one is just recognizing when you're walking whether or not there's ease or agitation, you know, and trying to find a pace of walking that brings you ease. So kind of controlling the pace of walking a little bit until you find a pace that feels comfortable. When I'm mindful, I find whenever I'm mindful, whatever I'm doing, there's almost always some pace at which the mind is most comfortable being mindful. And that's the pace where you'll feel that ease. And it will tend to support the mindfulness if you find that pace. It'll be a little bit pleasant. The walking experience will be a little bit pleasant because of that ease. And that will tend to draw the mind also back to the present moment. So that's the first one. Very simple. Just see if you can find a pace when you're walking that feels comfortable, that feels easeful. Anytime you're walking, walking between the house and the car, or the car and the grocery store, or around the office, or around the neighborhood, walking your dog, or just going for your run or whatever your exercise is. Just seeing if you can find a pace that brings you ease. The second one is, it's kind of more formal practice. It's more, if you find it difficult to stay present when you're walking, there's another technique that I sometimes teach, which is an alternation going through various sense experience to contact seeing, hearing, the body moving through space, and feet on the ground. So just taking a few steps, knowing that you're seeing, recognizing that seeing is happening. Maybe, 10, 15 seconds of that. And then switching to hearing. And then switching to the body moving through space. And then switching to the feet on the ground. And some people find this conscious practice of switching between the objects supports a more continuous mindfulness while walking. And this can get very open and spacious at times, and over times, if you do this a lot, you'll start to notice that while you're seeing, oh, there's hearing. Or while you're hearing, you'll notice seeing and moving. And at that point, when you start to kind of recognize that they're bleeding together, you can stop doing the kind of controlled technique and just let yourself know when you're seeing, when you're hearing, when you're moving, when you're touching your feet on the ground. This can be a very relaxing practice. When people have reported back about it, they have often talked about how supportive it is and how how relaxing it is and how continuous it makes the mindfulness while walking. So the second aspect that the Buddha talks about, of mindfulness in daily life, is called clear comprehension, or sometimes called full awareness. The term in Pali is sampajanya, and it's translated either as clear comprehension or full awareness. And this section is also pretty simple. Act in full awareness when going forward and returning. Act in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Act in full awareness when flexing and extending your limbs. Act in full awareness when wearing robes and carrying outer robes and bowl. That one doesn't apply to us. Act in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. Act in full awareness when defecating and urinating. Act in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. So that covers most of our activities. And a few pieces about this I'd like to point out. He kind of breaks it down into some kind of basic activities, like extending and bending. We do that a lot. You know, going to and coming back. So this kind of, again, we can use that practice that I just mentioned about setting our intention to remember something. Set your intention to try to remember one of these things. Maybe practice with the changing postures first for a while, but when you get that one down, pick something else from this list. Extending and bending. That's a real challenging one, because we do that. We probably do that every minute. It happens a lot. So that if we resolve to wake up for that, that's going to bring a real thread of mindfulness through our day. I also like to point out that he brings in urinating and defecating. This is something we often would think about. I mean, I think it's amazing that this is in the suttas. You know, it's like, we wouldn't think of this as being something spiritual. But it becomes that as we become mindful, as we allow it to be just part of our awareness of what we're doing. So I think he throws this in here to tell you, no, you don't get any breaks. Basically, he's saying, all day long. That's the goal. You know, be present all day long. Now, I personally have found that if I started out by trying to set my intention, I'm just going to be aware all day long. I failed. It didn't work. And I gave up because I failed. So somewhere at one point, I managed to read a little hint that said, pick a project rather than trying to be mindful all day. And so that's what I did. I picked a project, and that's where my mindfulness practice began. It was through picking projects in daily life to be aware of. I did this before I started sitting. I wasn't interested in sitting meditation. I thought I'd never be interested in sitting meditation. But the mindfulness in daily life was something I was very intrigued by. And so picking these projects. And this is a huge part of what I teach in this householder retreat. And essentially, the suggestion I made about moving between postures would be a project that you could pick. Just see if you can get to the place where you can pay attention when you change posture. And then maybe try adding something else. And adding something else. And I found that doing this over time, there becomes a thread. It's not perfect by any means. I mean, the practice is to attempt to be mindful all day long, and we're not going to succeed at that probably till we're fully enlightened. The Buddha is supposed to be mindful all day long, but I think until that point, it's not going to happen. So the point isn't necessarily to strive for that, but more to notice when we are aware and when we wake up, that moment when we wake up again. And taking some interest in somebody today in one of my interviews was talking about how she was getting interested in the exploration of extending the mindfulness that she'd started when she got out of bed and was extending into her self-care and showering. And at some point in there, she'd get lost. And beginning to take an interest in that, what is it that I get hooked to? We can start to actually recognize when our mindfulness is losing touch with what we're paying attention to. It's not so much an on and off kind of thing. It kind of drifts a little bit, and we can be aware, what am I getting pulled by? And not then that we necessarily have to come back to paying attention to washing our face or extending and bending our limbs, but what is the mind doing? Where is it going? What is it hooking on to? We can pay attention to that as well. And that's where I think the daily life practice really starts to get juicy. We start to see where we react, where we get caught by things. And we can start to unhook ourselves as we become aware of it. If we're not aware of it, we have no hope in unhooking ourselves. So this term, clear comprehension or full awareness, it's not particularly defined. The Buddha doesn't define it. But there's this whole body of literature called the commentaries, and they define it for us. So I'm going to just go over the parts that they talk about, because I think they're very interesting pieces for us to explore in our applying our mindfulness to our daily life. So these four aspects of clear comprehension are clear comprehension of purpose, clear comprehension of suitability, clear comprehension of domain, and clear comprehension of reality or non-delusion. Literally, the word translated as non-delusion. And I'll go over each of these. So the first two, purpose and suitability, are primarily about the content of what we're doing, or the aim or purpose of what we're doing in our activity. So this is primarily about speech and bodily action. So as we do things, there's a purpose to it. There's an aim to what we're doing. So this relates to the practical purposes of daily life and how they relate to our highest ideals. Are our practical purposes serving our highest ideals? So the teaching on the clear comprehension of purpose is to start to try to get these two in line so that what we're doing in our daily lives is headed in the direction of our highest ideals. So that our activities are in accord with our aims, with our aspirations. So this means considering priorities and looking at what we're doing, having our activities come into line with our priorities. So again, it's helpful to look at our intention, looking at why we're doing things. So another practical suggestion for daily life practice is to pause before acting. Pause before speaking. Pause before we do something. And it helps in that pause. If you have been able to pause before you speak, for instance, then you have caught the intention to speak, because you know you're about to speak and you've stopped yourself. So you've caught that intention. So pausing before you speak, you've caught the intention. And in that pause, you'll probably know what you are going to say and why you are going to say it. So you'll have an inkling of the intention behind it. in this observation of the intention, so really looking at purpose is kind of a meditation on intention. It's coming back to looking at what our intentions are, why we engage in our activities. We might discover that we don't always act in accord with our true interests. True interests being what leads us away from suffering. There might be a distinction between what we usually call our best interest and our true interests. And this was highlighted for me. Today I was looking at a Newsweek and there was this little snippet highlighted in the middle of the Newsweek page, an article by Warren Buffett. And the quote read, "When forced to choose, I would not trade even a night's sleep for a chance at extra profit." To me, that's a misunderstanding of true interest. So, our true interest is in learning how to let go of greed, aversion, and delusion. So sometimes we can't prevent ourselves from acting on unskillful motivations or not acting in ways that are in our true interests. And the practice of mindfulness here is not to beat ourselves up about that, but rather to observe what's going on, what's happening here. So we try to observe our motivations, our actions, the consequences of those motivations, and treat ourselves with compassion when we find that our patterns are so strong that we don't really have a choice. Sometimes our patterns and habits of greed and aversion and delusion are so ingrained that even if we're watching them with mindfulness, we can just, all we get to do is just watch ourselves do them. Then we need to bring some compassion to our practice, to our experience. The Anapanaka Thera has a beautiful phrase. He's a monk who has done quite a bit of commentaries, modern-day commentaries on the suttas, and he has some lovely writings. He says, with respect to this, looking at our unskillful intentions and being compassionate about them, he says, we aim for a peaceful penetration of the irrational regions of our mind. I liked that. So this clear comprehension of purpose doesn't mean that we can't relax. It doesn't mean that we can't go out with friends or spend time just allowing our mind to drift. What it is talking about is understanding how it supports our purpose, our true interests. So allowing the mind to drift can have a purpose that serves our true interest. It may allow us to engage in some creativity. Seeing friends allows us to make connections, particularly with Dharma friends, people who have similar values and ideals, sharing experiences. Relaxing. I talked about that last week. Relax. Let yourselves relax. It's okay. So the key is to be clear on whether the purpose of these actions is skillful or unskillful. But mixed motivations will exist until the end of our time. So part of what I like to explore when I see mixed motivations is to look at, okay, well, I see this mixed bag of things. Can I kind of emphasize or see if I can act out of the more skillful side? So holding both of them and seeing if I can act more from the skillful motivations, the ones of connection, compassion, generosity, kindness. So that's clear comprehension of purpose. Suitability is very closely related to purpose. And this is more about where it's not always possible, given our lives, particularly as lay people, to choose the ideal path towards what is most in line with our true interests. So perhaps what's in most in line with our true interests is to go off and meditate all the time. That may not be possible, given that we have to support ourselves and feed ourselves and feed our families. So we need to look at the suitability of our actions, the suitability of earning a livelihood. It's a suitable behavior to earn a livelihood to support the practice. For me, this was a kind of a huge reframing for myself. At one point in my practice, I really felt like I wanted to dedicate my life to the Dharma. And I took a couple of years off to do intensive retreat and pretty much spend as much time as I could practicing. But then, you know, my money runs out and I need to get a job. And I remember having an interview with one of my teachers and saying, I just can't imagine putting on a business suit and like going out there and interviewing. I just don't want to do that. And she said, well, you don't have to do that. But you also don't have to turn out a job if it lands in your lap. And I thought, oh, well, that's an idea. You know, maybe I don't actually have to, you know, prostitute myself. but I came back from that retreat and a job landed in my lap. I didn't have to do a thing. And it's like, well, okay, maybe this is the Dharma taking care of me. You know, maybe I don't have to resist this work and put it at odds with the practice. And I began to reframe my livelihood as a way to support my practice. It's what enabled me to go on retreats. It's what enabled me to begin to teach that livelihood. So I began reframing my practice. It wasn't something that was at odds with my practice. It became an integral part. The whole purpose of it became an integral part. And then the daily life practice in the work made it even more rich. So this is what I think it means by this suitability of purpose. I mean the clear comprehension of suitability. Looking at whether what we're doing can be seen as a support for our highest goals and aims. Even if it may not be what we'd think of as the ideal. The third aspect, there's clear comprehension of suitability and purpose. The third is of domain. And the term here is the word for field or pasture. So it's kind of like where do we pay attention? What is it that we pay attention to? And in daily life, it really is everything. I think that's what the Buddha was saying, you know, urinating and defecating included. Everything is possible. So the domain of meditation is really awareness. The domain of our practice in daily life is being aware. When we are aware, we are in the domain. When we're lost, we've gone out of the field. The cows left the pasture. When we've gone off in our thoughts, there's been a gate breached. So coming back into awareness, but the good thing about this is that, you know, as we come back into awareness, it's like we don't have to get the cow and bring it back in. We're already there. Wherever the cow is, that's where the domain is, as long as we wake up into that awareness. So we don't have to fight, like, bringing the cow back and struggling to get our minds back somewhere. When we wake up into awareness, we're there. So beginning to recognize when we wake up into mindfulness, this is what it's talking about, the clear comprehension of domain. A quote from Shantideva about this that's a great kind of mantra, perhaps, to reflect on during your day. How can the practice of mindfulness be performed under these very circumstances? How can the practice of mindfulness be performed under these very circumstances? The last piece is clear comprehension of reality or non-delusion. And this is essentially, the commentaries say, this relates to seeing our experience as a unfolding flow of causes and conditions, no one running the show, no one doing, no one experiencing, just experiencing happening, just doing happening, no one doing it. So this is essentially around the understanding of anatta or not self, this clear comprehension of reality or non-delusion. A lot of this kind of understanding results from practice more than being a practice itself. There is a way that that we can practice with this, but it's not so much experiential. Mostly the experience we have is that we feel like we are a self. We feel like there's somebody running the show. The exploration is about, what is that experience? What does it feel like? What is the experience that I'm having? What is that experience? What we see as we start to explore that is intention, action, intention, action, intention, action, just unfolding as a series of causes and conditions. So the observation through mindfulness will reveal this to us. It's not something to look for. You know, we can't really look for nothing. It's much more revealed to us as we pay attention. So it results, an understanding of this more results from attending to our experience. And the first three kinds of clear comprehension point us in the direction of what to pay attention to. So it's not something to believe, but something to that will be experienced if you contact your experience directly in a kind of continuous fashion. The continuity of mindfulness over time is what will reveal this aspect of not self. There are a couple of reflections that we can use if you're interested in exploring this a little bit, and you can kind of get maybe little hints of what it might mean. And these are, as something's happening for us, you know, perhaps some emotional pattern or habit that we really get hooked to, just saying to yourself, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. So just using that as a reflection. Sometimes there can be a little bit of letting go of the pattern if you just consciously throw that in there, using it, you know, just dropping that into your mind stream. But not to find anything or look for anything in particular. It just kind of maybe inclines the mind a little bit towards that letting go. So for me, this daily life practice has been a huge part of my practice. As I said before, it's how I began the meditation practice. And it has been so fruitful for me in terms of seeing into patterns and getting unstuck and unhooked from so much suffering. I can't express to you enough how I wish for you that you can also use this practice for yourselves in your daily life and see the benefits, see the freedom that can be gained from this kind of engagement in our daily lives. So, looks like we have 2 minutes. If there's anybody who has something they'd like to say or add. Why don't we just sit for 2 minutes? How can the practice of mindfulness be performed under these very circumstances? Thank you for your attention.